Hey, Leading LDS World, I just want to stop, take a moment, and say thank you. Thank you for Giving Tuesday. If you are not familiar with what happened this past Giving Tuesday, which is the Tuesday every year after Thanksgiving, we did a webathon where we went around the whole world. And in 24 hours, yours truly stayed up, I guess it was more like 36 hours. I was complete time I was awake, went around the world and interviewed 21 different leaders in different parts of the world. And it was fascinating, really fun event. I look forward to doing it next year. People are always asking me, are you crazy enough to do that 2 years in a row? And I think I will. It was a lot of fun. We'll do some different things next year. But we had huge growth, huge people jumping on, donating, becoming core leaders. Now, it's important for you to know that we still haven't hit our goals that we set for Giving Tuesday, but that's okay. We have till the end of the year to hit those. And so as December marches on, we encourage you to go over to leadinglds.org, hit the donate button. And seriously, folks, this is the time to become a core leader with Leading LDS, which means you're a monthly or yearly contributor, whether it's $1 a month, $12 a year, it makes a difference. And we need you part of the team, part of the community to contribute to carry this mission forward. So go to leadinglds.org and hit that donate button and make this happen. Now on to the next project, which is in January, maybe February 2018. I'm still trying to get things in line for this. We are announcing, we are putting on the Teaching Saints Virtual Summit. As many of you that are familiar with virtual summits, we actually did a Motivating the Minister virtual summit, which more to come on that in the future. But virtual summit is an online summit that, like a conference, anybody can attend through the magic of the internet and their computer. And we are having 30 plus presenters, including Brad Wilcox, Jason Hewlett, Maria Eckersley, Jeff Burke, Scott Newman, and more. I just haven't been recorded yet. And we are talking all things teaching in the church, the tactics of teaching, the skill of teaching, how to improve teaching in a ward. So this is one you definitely don't want to miss. And to make sure you don't miss it, you need to go to leadinglds.org and sign up for the newsletter, where we'll be pushing out additional announcements and information as it gets closer. This is definitely one you'll want to share with your ward council, the teachers in your ward, the Sunday school presidency. Everybody involved in teaching, even if it's speaking and sacramenting, will be blessed by the content here. 30 plus hours of content, all based around the skills and tactics of teaching so that we can create a better experience for those participating in the gospel. So head on over to leadinglds.org and be sure you're on the newsletter to get that information. All right, here's this week's interview. Leading LDS is a nonprofit organization dedicated to enhancing leadership ability and capacity of lay leaders in order to accelerate the mission of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Leading LDS is not owned nor operated by the LDS Church, and any opinions expressed on this podcast do not reflect the views of any specific organization. All donations given to Leading LDS are tax deductible and go towards the support of Leading LDS. For more information, visit leadinglds.org. Welcome back to the Leading LDS Podcast. My name is Kurt Frankham, your host, and I have a guest before the guest. Here I am with Nathan Mills. How are you, Nathan?
I'm fantastic.
Good. Now, I literally just handed him the microphone and said, we're going to do this introduction, but tell me how you emailed me a few weeks back and helped set up this interview. Tell us how you came across Leading LDS and what got you to sit down in front of your computer, actually email me.
Okay. Well, this is going to be a shout out to BYU fans everywhere.
Nice.
I read about Leading LDS on cougarboard.com.
Oh, nice.
And
what's your handle there?
I don't know if I'm ready to...
All right. That's fine.
A little anonymity.
I'm Leading LDS on Cougarboard.
Right, okay, so. Well, that's easy. There are a few people there who know who I am. But no, it came highly regarded. And I have a longer commute, actually, than Don does. I live in Santaquin. I just gave a little bit away there. But I have this long commute, and it was recommended to me online, and so I started to listen to it, and I got one episode almost finished as I pulled into the garage here at our office, and I couldn't go into the office. I had to finish it, and as I was walking into the office, I thought, you know, this is the kind of thing that the Don Adams ought to do, and he's been a great leader for our company.
Nice.
And so I've been just impressed with, you know, all of the guests. I have many more to listen to still, but nice. It's been a fantastic help for me, and I've shared it with other people as well.
Nice. So just in a few sentences, who's Don and what should we expect listening to this?
So Don, Don is just about to retire from Bear River Mutual, and I've only been here 4 years, but you know, Don's had a great effect on me in my life as a worker, but he's been a leader in this business and for this company during a very interesting transition. of high growth and of big challenges. And I know that everyone here is going to miss him when he retires. He's finishing up creating our company history as kind of his kind of last project with us. But I know that you know, he has been an example of compassion and friendship and an example to all of us. And so I've just, it's been an honor for me to work with him. And so I'm happy for others to hear about his experiences and his advice.
Yeah. And this is a great interview. We cover a lot of topics, everything from interviewing youth to, you know, leading, encouraging or allowing people to fail and learning from our own failures as leaders. So we're definitely, I mean, excited to share this with the Leading LDS audience. Obviously, as I always do, before we jump into this interview, I encourage you to be a core leader with Leading LDS by going to leadinglds.org, hitting the donate button and contributing at least a dollar a month, $12 a year, whatever it is, and get, set it and forget it on a subscription basis. And that's how we keep this mission moving forward, is through your contributions. We couldn't do it without you. So go to leadinglds.org and hit donate. And now here's our interview with Dodd Adams, the CEO of Bear River Mutual. Today, I find myself in a beautiful office building with Don Adams, who's the CEO of Bear River Mutual. How are you, Don?
I'm very good. Thank you.
Nice. Now, how long have you been here, Bear River Mutual?
I have been here not quite 18 years. This next spring would be 18 years. I'm just in the process of retiring after 43 years in the insurance business at the end of this year. So,
yeah. And so you're going out on a good note, and they're not driving you out or anything like that.
That is correct. I have not been kicked to the curb or anything like that. So I'm going out on a high for me.
Awesome. And as I'm driving here, all I can hear is your jingle, the Bear River Mutual jingle in my head over and over. So your marketing must be working.
It has. In fact, that was all created during my time as president and CEO.
Wow.
Our advertising really didn't start until about the year 2002 mm-hmm. is when we really formally started to do some advertising. We created the jingle, and we created TV and radio ads. That was the beginning back in 2002.
That's great. That's great. And so what does the audience need to know about you, whether it's related to Bear River Mutual or your personal life? What defines you as an individual?
Well, I'm like most typical guys out on the street. I grew up on a farm in Southeast Idaho. So I have that farming background, which has had a major impact on how I do things. I have been involved in insurance for a long time. I started back in 1974 with Safeco Insurance Company in the San Francisco Bay Area. Eventually ended up in Utah. I also, prior to that, served in the United States military. I got my commission from, while I was attending, actually, BYU, and I was commissioned as an officer in the United States Army, and was a medical officer for 2 years on active duty, and that was a great experience as well. Hmm. I graduated, actually, from BYU in elementary education.
Oh, wow.
I was a school teacher.
So you could go in the insurance business, right?
And I never in a million years thought I was going to go into the insurance business. I did that actually after I got out of the military. We had to make the decision, should we go back into education or do we look at business, et cetera? And I actually had a position selling hospital equipment. That was my first job. And I was just 2 days away from beginning when the recruiter asked if I would actually talk with this company and interview just as a courtesy to him. And I did. And they offered me a job and I turned it down. And another vice president offered me a job on the spot. And I kind of got interested and thought, well, maybe this is a good way to gain just a couple of a year's experience in business. I don't really like insurance, but if I maybe just learn some basics and work on the backside, maybe that'll give me some experience and I'll do it for 2 years. Mm-hmm. Well, 43 years later, I haven't figured out quite how to get out of the business. And I found that it was much bigger and much more involved and much broader in scope than I had ever imagined. And, it's been an exciting journey for the last 43 years.
Yeah. And you mentioned nobody really likes insurance, right? I mean, nobody wakes up or as a little boy, you don't hear them stand in front of their kindergarten class, I'm going to sell insurance when I'm older, right? So how do you create passion? And obviously, as a leader in this industry, how do you transfer that passion to those that you lead in your company that at the end of the day, yeah, we're sort of selling a product that's sort of boring but necessary. Right. But how do you bring right. passion out of it?
Well, one of the things that I have done here that I've talked a lot about here is that if insurance is done correctly, we are a very essential part and part of a noble cause in the community. Mm-hmm. if you look at the fires, for instance, right now that are burning in California, there's over 5,200 structures that have been burned in the last week. Who's going to come to the table and actually help put those families and those lives back together? If they've had a good insurance company, they're already on the spot. They're working with them to rebuild their home, to replace their contents, and to provide housing and a life for them while all of that's being done. That's part of the noble cause. Without a good insurance company, everybody else comes to the table and just says, oh, it's so sad that so-and-so's house burned down, or it's so sad that Mary was in a car accident. But if you've got a good insurance company, they will take the time to work with you to help put you back on your feet.
Yeah.
And so that's how you get the passion, is you say, we're a part of a noble cause if we do it right and if we treat people fairly and right.
Yeah.
So that's what we tell all of our people. At the end of the day, did you do the right thing? Did you try to help people? And even if they don't have coverage, did you still help them as a human being? Did you still take the extra 30 seconds and try to provide some ways for them to still get what they need, even though there may not be coverage on the policy?
Yeah. And so, I mean, insurance is boring until you need it. And then it's
that's correct. And then it becomes a necessity, and it's a great blessing when you have it with the right company.
That's great. What about, you know, you mentioned, what part of Southeast Idaho did you grow up?
I grew up outside of Blackfoot. I grew up in a small community close to Aberdeen. It was a small school. We only had, in my graduating class, there was only 76 of us that made it to the end of the high school.
Was it Snake River High?
It's the one just further west from Snake River.
Oh, okay.
I played against Snake River in all kinds of sports, et cetera. I knew a lot of people from Snake River High.
This is where my wife, from Pingree, Idaho.
That's even closer to me.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
If you just keep coming down the road, about another 5 to 10 miles, that's where I am.
Yeah, great part of the country, for sure. I love going up there and getting away from the city and being among the
absolutely.
Potatoes. So.
Right.
That's awesome. So what about your development of your testimony as an individual? How would you articulate that?
Growing up in a small town, actually in the country, I grew up in a small country church. I had some great leaders who were farmers, and we worked hard and we played hard. I really always knew the church was true, but I really didn't gain my testimony until I left on my mission. I went to the Central States Mission. Our headquarters was in Independence, Missouri. And it was really in the mission field that I not only knew it was true, but I finally had a number of experiences where I couldn't deny that it was true. And it changed my whole life. My mission was, I was one of those products of the missionary who went out. I had no problem with anything, but I really gained my testimony and it changed my life once I got in the mission field and started working with people. And was questioned on my testimony, you know, why do you believe that? I was challenged, you know, how could you believe that? And I had to do some real soul searching the first 30 to 60 days of my mission and say, well, do I really believe? And if so, why am I here? Because if I don't believe, this is not necessarily a fun experience at this stage. I'm being questioned. I'm being challenged. And I've got to know. And I had a number of just really special experiences that I could not deny that fact. And it changed my life.
Yeah. So you come home from your mission and that sort of, I mean, would you define your mission as sort of that it really imprinted that conviction on your soul?
It did. I have never been the same since. I had attended what was then Ricks College in Southeast Idaho. Before I went on my mission, when I came home, I transferred to BYU. I just felt like that was where I needed to be. Ricks was a two-year college, and I needed to decide what I was going to go into. And I ended up going into education, mainly because while I was on my mission, I ended up being over the Lamanite region in Oklahoma for my last 12 months, and it was like a separate mission. And I taught seminary, and I taught a lot of different seminary classes to a lot of the Lamanite kids and the various tribes, et cetera. And that changed my life. And I liked to teach. I liked to work with groups, individuals or groups of people. And that's what got me into education. And I was having so much fun with the kids that I thought, well, maybe that's why I should go into elementary education. And so that's what I ended up getting my degree in at BYU.
And did you feel like when you made that shift to business, did you ever think, this means I won't teach as much? Or?
No. In fact, what I've really found out is I teach all the time. I've always been in a leadership role from the moment I graduated from college and went into the military. And from my first job in the insurance industry, I was in a supervisory role. That was my first job. And everything that I did was teach. And I found that all the principles that I had learned in teaching also applied in the business world, because you're looking at what needs to be done and then how do you communicate that information to other people. And the things that I learned in leadership roles in the mission, as well as my teaching degree, I said those two things actually was my foundation all through my business career. And in my service in the church, it's in both of those areas. Most of what I learned in those 3 to 4 year period of time when I was first getting started. The principles have never changed.
So it sounds like in your mind, I mean, leadership really is synonymous with teaching.
Absolutely. Yeah. And if you're going to be a good teacher, you have to be a good example. People have to want to listen to what you have to say. You can't, in teaching, you find very quickly, you can't say one thing and live another.
Yeah.
If you don't have passion for a topic, if you don't have passion for your industry or for your company as a whole, you're likely not going to move the group very far, because people want a leader that they want to emulate. They want a leader that they want to follow, that they know is going to be working side by side with them and is going to treat them a certain way, all those kinds of things. And so those experiences became very critical for me.
Yeah.
And I learned a lot of my values in the country, on the farm in Idaho. I had a lot of time to think on a tractor out in the fields for hours and hours and hauling hay when no one else was around. And you had a lot of time to think about things.
Yeah. They didn't have podcasts back then.
They didn't have a lot of things back then.
Nice. And now I go on my father-in-law's tractor and they have GPS. I mean, you just set it and read the newspaper or whatever.
I tell my brother, who is still up on the farm, he has all these swathers and their cabs and their air conditioning and stereo systems. And I'm saying, all I had was open air and lots of mosquitoes.
Yeah.
We didn't have all this stuff.
Yeah.
We didn't even have little transistor radios for the most part back then.
Right. There's probably something in personal development that farmers are missing these days, that silence that you just miss out on, you know?
But we did have a lot of time to think about things and what we wanted to do in our lives. So,
you know, I love this approach to, you know, leadership that you talk about teaching, that to be a teacher, your example goes along with that. And I would imagine, you know, over your time as your professional and religious leadership time, any examples come as far as how you went about that? Was, you know, maybe introducing a new concept or teaching something and then reminding yourself, okay, I've asked them to do this. Now I've got to make sure I'm doing that. Any right. examples come to mind?
I know in teaching any concept, whether it be in the church or in the business world, you have to take the time to think through the process, understanding who's your audience? Where are they? You know, how do they view the world, or how do they view circumstances at the present time? If you have the opportunity to develop a relationship with people first, now sometimes in some settings, you know, it's fresh, it's a new group, it's somebody that you just come upon, you don't have that opportunity. But I've found if you can establish a relationship with a person and or with a group of people, and or even if you're teaching in front of a group you've never met before, if you can establish a rapport with them where they begin to just feel comfortable that you're not somebody who thinks knows everything, but that you're just one of them and you've come up through the ranks, you've had to work hard to get where you are, but you're kind and you can establish that rapport quickly, then you can talk about a lot of things, because you don't want to be judgmental, et cetera. And little things that you do in how you approach the crowd, your tone of voice, your demeanor, all those kind of things go a long way in helping to establish a safe zone or a zone where people can say, okay, he is someone, let me listen to for a little bit, see if what he says makes sense.
Yeah.
Whether it's, you know, in front of a group of kids or an elders quorum that you're talking about home teaching, you know, sometimes you have these topics where everybody knows the right answer, but nobody's performing.
And you say, I have no idea what you're talking about. Yeah, I've never seen this.
I know. It's one of those mysteries of the church.
Yeah.
But you have to do it in a way where you say, okay, can we break it down? Can we just do this one thing? Will everybody at least be willing to commit to make contact with your families in the next 2 weeks? Would you do that? And would you let us know that you have? Because half the battle with any assignment, whether it's in a business setting or especially in the church, is getting your foot out the door, just deciding you're going to do it. Once you decide and once you start moving, you typically, I know in my life, I've asked, why didn't I do this earlier? This is okay. This is a great experience. I had a great opportunity to interact with somebody and they made me a better person. And I hope I had a good positive influence on them as well.
Yeah. You know, I love that concept of establishing that rapport as a leader, because sometimes as leaders, you know, I think of a bishop, you know, that may see some problems happening and feels like I need to stand at a lectern and implement a system or a policy or a new program. And, you know, hopefully they'll follow that because I'm the bishop, but really to take the time and ask yourself, you know, how are they going to receive that? And especially how are they going to receive it from me?
Right.
You know, do I have rapport with them that they're even going to listen? Or are they going to be skeptical of everything that I'm putting out? Maybe I don't, you know, that bishop doesn't understand me. So he just doesn't get it. Right.
Right.
And so really working at establishing that rapport. So how do you do that? How do you, is there any process or tactics you go about maybe in the office of a new employee, really establishing rapport with that individual?
You have to take the time to get to know them. It's not about you. So if you start asking questions about their background or who they are, or where they're from, or what they're interested in, et cetera, then they have a tendency to start saying things like, well, maybe he wants to know about me, really. Mm-hmm. I found it especially when I was a bishop interviewing the youth. I recognized early on that was going to be my focus. When I was first bishop, I was 34 years old, I believe. And so I was young. I had a young family. I have six sons and a daughter that we adopted.
Oh, wow.
And so I found that you had to take the time to get to know the youth. And so I found that by getting to know them and talking to them and then going where they go, I'd go to their baseball games or the football games or the concerts, et cetera, and I'd see them there. And they would see me there. I would walk the neighborhood. I knew where the kids were more than their parents. Because I was where they were. Yeah. I played basketball with them. I played sports with them. I did all kinds of things. And that was a great opportunity. At that point, I had about 60 young men, young women in my ward, and I probably had another 25 to 30 young single adults in my ward at the time. So I was probably the right bishop at that time for that group of people. Yeah. But I found by getting to know them and spending the time with them and spending a lot of time interviewing them, that helped me a long ways to reaching them and developing a rapport. I know there were times when I'd see some young men that, you know, they would almost, they'd be brought to the church for an interview and they'd beat their parents home. Even though the parent was in the car, they'd almost beat the parent home before the parent got there and the interview was over. I'm thinking, that wasn't an interview. They didn't spend enough time to get to know them. So I found spending the time and developing the rapport and having that one-on-one relationship has been probably one of my marks of implementation that I've used in business and in the church. Take the time to make sure that they know you care about them first before you get into anything you want to do.
Yeah. And when you say, you know, taking the time, that's what I'm hearing is that, you know, you're being present at the activities. You're being aware of their personal interests and what's going on in their life through those interviews. And just to magnify that a little more, was there specific go-to questions you had in those interviews? Or where, did you maybe start the first 10 minutes of, you know, how's school, how's home? Or
I would do some of the general things, saying, you know, how's school going? Or, you know, what's your favorite subject? You know, why do you like that? Do you know of anybody that also does that for a living? Or, you know, I know somebody that's interested in that, et cetera. So you do some general questions like that. Most of the time, all you'd have to do is just say, talk to me about what's going on in your life these days. Tell me, you know, what are you doing in school? What are you doing? What are you reading? What kinds of activities do you like to attend, et cetera? And if you would take the time to quit talking and
stop a minute, let's emphasize that.
And then sit back and just let them talk. They would open up. Now, it might be not on the first interview, but on the second interview, if you were still very casual and you weren't pressing too much, if they got to the point where they felt like they had a relationship, then they could trust you. And if there's trust involved, then it's amazing how much people will open up. And I found that, especially even with the youth, they'll tell me all kinds of things. I found out things I really wished I hadn't heard. But they were very good at opening up. But they had to trust you first.
Yeah. And, you know, I've often said one of the most underrated leadership principles is approachability. How approachable are you right. as a leader? You know, we use these this jargon of, oh, I've got an open door policy. You know, right. you can always come in here. But that doesn't mean anything if you're not approachable. And that's so right. much more than just having an open door policy, right?
Oh, that's
especially
right.
with youth.
Oh, absolutely. I like the fact that even here, people will come into my office and I'll tell them, I typically we'll conduct quarterly meetings with all the employees and we'll talk to them. And I try to make them feel that they know me well enough that if they have a question about anything, that they can walk into my office and I'll tell them, listen, if I can't talk to you because I'm tied up in something that's really important or I've got somebody in my office, that's one thing. But I'll tell you if I do. Otherwise, it may be just one of the other executives that I'm talking to and there's no reason why we can't spend some more time. And I'll just say, oh, hey, come on in, and I'll ask the executive to leave. Mm. Once you do it enough times, the word spreads. You don't have to put it on neon lights. You don't have to advertise it. Once somebody has a good experience, they will tell the rest of the employees. That's just human nature. And that's what I've found has worked very well for me here.
Yeah. And really establishing a culture of that. You know, it's one thing correct. To say it and to be the leader. Well, I told them I had, you know, they'd come talk to me anytime they wanted, yeah. but they didn't. Yeah. So, well, you know.
And for some, you've learned, yeah, right. You step through that threshold and yeah. it's in no man's land and you might come out whole yeah. and you might not.
Yeah, exactly.
It's amazing what happens if you actually do it and you do what you say. And if people find that it's actually a pleasant experience. I also here at the company, I spend a lot of time walking just around the company, talking to the employees. I want to know about them personally. If there's something going on or somebody's got a broken arm in their family or whatever, you know, I'll go back and ask again, how are they doing? And they're always surprised. He actually asks about my son or daughter or something like that. But I want them to know they're real people and that I'm not any more important than they are. I just have a different job. I just have a different responsibility. That's all. But when it comes to how we treat people, all those kinds of things, I'm just the average person.
Yeah.
I just have different responsibilities from time to time.
Yeah. Love that. You know, and going back to as far as interviews with youth, because I think there's a lot of bishops, especially out there, or even youth leaders who really struggle with connecting. And they may say, well, you know, it's different. We got millennials or what do they call them now? Generation Z or whatever that the youth are. You know, they don't know how to communicate. And so it's one thing to say, you know, yeah, I want to be the bishop that sits back and listens or the youth leader that does that, but I can't even get them to talk. Right. Any ideas or approaches to warm them up a little bit so they actually will talk so you can listen?
Well, what I found is if you are happy and if you're not asking too many questions, and you try to have to keep the questions open-ended. Mm. If you give them a closed question where they only need to say yes or no, that's all you're going to get is yes or no. You have to say, tell me about something or tell me how things are going at school. And you have to just keep bouncing till you find something that they're willing to even respond on. Mm. And if they're not responding, you don't make a big deal about it. You say, is there anything that, you know, we can talk about? Mm-hmm. And sometimes they'll open up. I can't remember a situation where I didn't have somebody actually start talking to me. Mm. But my wife always gave me a bad time anyway. She used to say I could walk up to a drive-in window to get a hamburger, and by the time I get to the front of the line, I've already figured out all the life histories from everybody in front of me. But part of that is you just have to be personable.
Yeah.
And I like people. I like to be around people. And I learned one of the values I learned early in that farming community was you treated everybody right. Mm. You treated everybody like they were at the same level as you were. Nobody was better than anybody. Nobody had anything better than you did. You just didn't think that way.
Yeah.
And that was a real blessing for me to learn that yeah. value.
Yeah. And, you know, so you have to be personable. And a lot of people may say, well, you know, I'm just not that guy. But I've learned from my experience, being personal really is a skill that you need to develop, not just something, a trait that you're born with. Right?
I think some people struggle with it because they don't know what to say. They mm-hmm. don't know how to deal with it. Two things. One, ask some questions. And then the second issue is be prepared to just go quiet for a few minutes. If you quit talking, people get very nervous. But if you can do something to break it down and make light of it or or have a little fun with them, et cetera, then typically they'll start to open up.
Yeah, love that. Anything else as far as interviews, youth interviews that, you know, connecting, open door policy type stuff that we haven't covered? Or
well, I just think the thing that I did is I got to be good friends with the youth, and there's a fine line. You have to be careful. You don't want to be at their level because you're trying to lift them up to yours, not go down to theirs. But I think by being around them and talking to them, having fun with them, playing different games with them, and not being afraid to get out and be a part of the activities, whether it's at Mutual or in showing up at their basketball game, and they realize, hey, the bishop's in the stands watching me. He didn't even have a son here, and so he didn't have to be here, or he doesn't have to spend the time even talking to me out here on the sidewalk as we're walking around the neighborhood, but he took the time to say hi, and he didn't make a big deal about it, but he went on his way.
Yeah.
I think you just build relationships by little things.
Yeah. And you mentioned before we recorded, you know, obviously you had your experience as being a bishop and working with youth, but also on a member of the High Council, you were over the youth programs.
Correct.
And so probably a lot of this comes from both of those experiences.
It does. I've had a lot of involvement with the youth over the course of my lifetime, whether it be involved with scouting or the youth activities as a whole, taking the stake to, you know, on campouts or the trek experience in Wyoming, that kind of thing. I've been involved at all in all of that. But it's been fun. And I think if the youth think that you think it's fun and that you're doing fun things with them, then that kind of helps build that rapport.
Yeah, love that. Well, and as I do on these How I Lead interviews, I generally ask those that I interview to put together 4 or 5 points, leadership principles that they've used in their life in both leadership and professional. And you've come very well prepared, Don. I can see how you can effectively run an organization here. So this is good. Yeah. You've got several things here. Is there, and we've sort of covered these, you know, you've talked about people relationships, and not that we can't go back and hit a different angle of that, but you talk about attitude, you know, is the glass half full or half empty? What is attitude? What's the role of attitude when it comes to leadership?
Well, I think how you approach things actually starts to set the tone. If you come to work happy and with a smile on your face, and if you are always looking at your organization, whether it's a calling in the church or a situation in your career, if you're approaching it with the idea that, okay, we've got some issues here, but the glass is half full, it's not half empty. The thing you learn in life, and as I am looking back over the course of my life, there's always problems, there's always issues. And I like to tell people, if there weren't issues or problems, then they wouldn't need me. Because that's what I do. I try to help resolve issues, and I try to help come up with appropriate approaches to fix the situation. But if you have the right attitude, it also builds hope and security in the people that are trying to follow you. If they think you're discouraged, or if they think that there's not a way to overcome the situation, they get very nervous very quickly, and they start either looking for new jobs or deciding to move out of the ward.
Yeah.
And so I've found that, and one of the things that I tell every new employee, and I've interviewed in the course of my time as president CEO, I've interviewed every employee before they're hired that comes into this company.
Huh.
And the two things that I tell them, you'll automatically be successful if you have two things. One, if you have a good attitude, if you come with the idea that I'm here to be a part of the solution, not a part of the problem. And if you also have a good work ethic, are you willing to take the time to just give me an honest day's work? You know, it'll be fun. We like to play as much as we work. And so it could be and should be a good experience here. But will you give me an honest day's work? Or are you just looking for the benefits and a way to make some money, and then you don't want to have anything to do with the organization? I'll know in a short period of time whether you want to really make a difference. And then my responsibility is to make sure that if you're going to come to work, then I'm supposed to help you find ways to become successful. That's my job, is to give you opportunities to become successful. And by doing that, you'll be happy and I'll be happy. And so if you have a good attitude and are willing to work, I don't think you're going to fail at this organization. And hopefully it'll either grow or you'll be able to move on to another organization, but you'll look back and say, that was a good experience. I learned a lot. They were very supportive, and we'll be the first to clap and cheer if it's a good situation for you, because life is too short.
You know, this concept of giving an honest day's work, I think that's, you know, I've had jobs in the past where I just sort of show up, and it's not that I'm trying to,
right,
you know, cheat my employer, but it's like, man, I'm just, I just need a job right now, and I'm not really passionate about what's going on here. And so I can see how that, you know, getting that understanding up front can be powerful. In a church context, was there any way as far as getting an honest day's work of those you lead in church? Because this is a difficult part of running volunteer organizations is you sort of feel like, well, I can ask that because, you know, we're just lucky they're in the seat. And yeah, if I ask right. more of them, who knows right. what they'll do.
Right? It's a very difficult thing because, you know, if they're not performing, it's difficult to fire them. Although there are times
when
you'd like to.
Can I recommend a good realtor?
yeah. You say, you were thinking about moving to another yeah. area, weren't you? But for the most part, you have to take people who are volunteer, and how can you encourage them to do better? Sometimes it's just fear on their part, or they don't know how to organize, or they don't know how to prioritize their time to get certain things done. And so sometimes you have to take the time to help them, but then you have to show them. It's difficult for somebody to be organized if they don't see you as the leader in a church setting also organized. Mm. Do you have an agenda for the meeting? Do you call meetings just to have meetings and we say the same thing that we said in the last six meetings? Or do you use your meetings to actually get something done? And when it's done, do you close the meeting? And do you always close when you said you were supposed to? But do you also take the chance to close ahead of time if we're done? People like that honesty. If you say, I value your time, this is not just to see if I can tie up all your day because my day's all tied up. I'd like to have people commiserate with me. Mm. And so how you approach that, I think, helps a lot of people in their callings. I have two sons that are currently bishops. And we smile because one of the things I've told them also is, you know, sometimes people will come to you and they've spent 25 years developing a problem, but they expect you to fix it in 5 minutes. And I said, so how do you handle that? And we were just talking about this just a couple of days ago, because I said, to tell them that very thing, listen, it's taken you a long time, but you know, I can give you some advice and I can talk to you and we can work through the issues. And I'm more than happy to spend whatever time is necessary, but just recognize I might need a night to think about it too. I can't fix your problem. It's taken years for you to develop, but also, you need to understand that if you're not willing to do what I ask you to do, then I'm probably not the one to fix your problem. Mm. And yeah. So I said, you've just got to be honest with people. But I said, never get pushed in a corner where they start yelling and screaming at you because, well, you've got to fix this. You've got to tell my wife that she's got to treat me better. Or you've got to tell my husband that he's got to be more respectful of me and stuff like that. You say, let's talk about this for a while.
Yeah.
You know? And so you have to keep that in mind that sometimes that's the expectation. You've got a 5-minute opportunity to fix yeah. their 25 year problem.
Yeah, that's a great way to, and really you're communicating there and creating an understanding of like,
absolutely.
Listen, this is, I realize you're looking for a solution, but this problem's taking a long time to develop. It's going to take a long time to unwind, right? But I love that, you know, going back to those initial phrases you use of, you know, you ask people for an honest day's work, but you can't do that unless you are willing to help them succeed at that right. honest day's work. And, you know, takes my mind to, you know, maybe being a bishop, you know, and you mentioned these meetings, that it's one thing if those that you lead aren't going to give that honest day's work or in their role, if you don't have an understanding of saying, listen, I need your help here. And what I'll do on my end is I'll keep the meetings brief. I'll cancel meeting if we really don't need it. Or, you know, I'll be respectful of your time. But the best way for you to show that respect back is let's get in this together and really create right. some good positive leadership and some good change and do some good while we're in these roles, right?
Right. It's been an interesting process. As you were talking, I couldn't help but think of, I've talked to many of the youth leaders when I was in these roles. And because many times the youth leaders are pushing all these activities and every activity has to be a perfect activity. And my comment would be, are you prepared? Number one, why are we having these youth activities? Is this all about just having fun or what? No, it's the preparation, it's the planning, it's the executing. What are we doing with our young people? We're teaching them to become leaders. Are you prepared to allow them to fail? Because what happens is most of the time the adults will swoop in. We got to make sure that this dance goes okay and we've got all the ingredients and everything is here for the refreshments, etc. And I said, let it fail. So, well, Bishop, we can't. This is a big activity for the whole year, and we've spent a lot of money. I said, let it fail, because that's the only way the youth learn. By the way, it's the only way adults learn too.
Yeah, it's a human experience.
You have to fail. In fact, I've come to realize that that's why we came to this earth. We get experience by failing. And Zig Ziglar, he made mention of that. I saw it just actually this morning. He said, failure is an event, not a person. And sometimes we forget that.
Yeah.
But in a lot of our activities, are we prepared to let the activity fail so that the youth can learn something? Do the leaders take the time to then say, okay, what went wrong? Who didn't fill their assignment? Or did we not prepare enough? What happened? Now, what can we do to make sure that doesn't happen again? Because until they've had that experience, they're going to do it again. Mm-hmm. And somebody else is going to pick up the pieces. That's why we have an entire society right now that's entitled, because everybody swoops in and takes care of things. And if they don't, well, then they have to blame everybody else for their problems in life, et cetera. And so a lot of our youth activities, this is a great opportunity to give the youth a chance to learn and grow, which is why we came to this earth in the first place, because we had to have experiences. And one of the points that I've talked to a lot of employees about is, okay, so you failed. Well, you didn't, if you learned something. The event didn't go quite well, but did you learn something? And if you did, what can you do differently? The whole secret there is, when you have had failure, get back up. I'm convinced in my life, even personally, the mistakes that I've made and the things that I've done wrong or the choices that I've made that weren't good, if I learn from them, then that's why the Savior and the Atonement is so critical, because that's what was supposed to happen. Now, if I don't care and I just throw everything to the wind and I keep making bad choices, well, I'll lose agency over time. But because of the Atonement, I can have a problem or I can fail, but I can overcome it. And so I think that's why the Lord looks at us and said, get back up. Get back up. Do you know who you are? Do you know who you're supposed to become? That's that idea of still forging forward even when we've been knocked down. And that's in the church. It's in our personal lives. It's in business.
Yeah. And I love, you know, the points you make there as far as sometimes I think as youth leaders or any type of leader, we worry that when people fail, they will project that on themselves, right? Going along with Zig Ziglar's quote that failure is an event, not a person, that we feel like, oh, we can't let them fail because we don't want to have them feel shameful or that there's something wrong with them. And so, like you said, that important next step of really breaking down what happened and helping them know you didn't fail because you learned something.
Yeah.
What a great opportunity.
Well, I think how you deal with a failure too as a leader is a big deal. Mm. If you turn it into a big negative situation and condemn, then that's one thing. Or you can make light of it and have fun with it and say, okay, what do we learn? Okay, you know, that hot dog would have tasted a lot better if we'd had ketchup. For some of you, it didn't matter. But for me, I needed ketchup on that hot dog. And so I'll bet you the next time we have one, the first thing you're going to do is say, you'll probably get ketchup before you get the hot dog. Is that correct? You know, if you have that kind of fun with the debriefing and the follow-up, then it can be a fantastic experience. But all too often we get mad at people. You didn't do this and you destroyed the whole activity, you know, or I had to run and go get something else, et cetera, et cetera. No, I think how you deal with it at the backside is also very critical. That's when you finally have the chance to learn something. And you can support and reinforce the correct principles.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. And this is one of, you know, we've sort of stumbled into another one of your principles here, which is great. Don't be afraid to fail. Anything else as far as failure is concerned that we haven't hit or need to expound on?
No, I think all too often it starts, for many of us, it started in school. If we didn't get the right answer and how the teacher responded, then we'd hesitate to try something. I think this is the key with a failure. We learn most of what we do by failing. A child, how many times do they fall in learning how to walk? They fall every 2 seconds initially, mm-hmm. but they keep getting back up. And eventually, they don't fall very much anymore. The same thing happens to us. Big piece about failure is that's how we learn a lot of things. There's a couple of things that I think we need to be aware of. One is don't be afraid to try. Don't try thinking I'm going to fail, but try thinking you're going to succeed. But then when you do fail, if something doesn't go wrong or right and it goes the wrong direction, then cut your losses and quit doing it and take a different approach. That's the other great principle that bishops also have to tell people. Sometimes when their activity continues to be bad, you have to only say two words, stop it. Just stop it. My sons and I were laughing about that the other day as well. But you learn from your mistakes. You have to get back up, but you have to recognize that not everything you do is perfect. In the business world, one of the things I learned years ago in studying a lot of key executives across the United States and those who would be deemed very successful, there was a report that said that 68% of them make a lot of mistakes all the time. But the difference is in the real successful CEO is they recognize the mistake early, recognize it for what it is, call it a mistake, say it wasn't the right decision, and change immediately instead of trying to carry it on or blame somebody else or whatever.
Hope it works out, right?
They take total ownership and they say, oh, that was a bad decision. It's my call. I didn't pick up on something, but we're going to change and we're going to change as we speak, and it's going to be changed today.
Yeah.
And that's what makes them successful. They're not afraid to keep trying things, because just like a young child, they're not afraid to keep trying things, and that's how they learn. If we could keep that same spirit with us all through our life, where we're not afraid to keep trying and to keep learning, then we'll make our mistakes, but we'll recover quickly.
Yeah. Love that. And my mind went to a book I read, you know, the Chip and Dan Heath are famous writers, and I think it's in their book Decisive, but they tell the scenario of this executive team, the CEO and, you know, this chief operating officer or something, but the company wasn't going well. And they both knew that, well, we're probably going to be fired here soon. And so they took a moment, stepped back and said, if we were the next guys that were hired, what would we do differently? And let's just start doing that. And just that exercise of stepping back and saying, what if we let go of every decision we've made up to this point and did something different? What would that look like? I think that's such a powerful exercise to do when you realize, man, I think I'm failing, but maybe we'll come out of this. But instead of standing around looking, if you do, what would you do if you didn't? And you could just move forward.
Right. Most of the time, you get a gut level feeling that it's wrong quickly.
Yeah.
If you listen to what you're feeling, many times you're right. And right or wrong, I mean, even if it's kind of a chancy situation that you're taking, and like, you know, life is full of risk, but you kind of know pretty quickly whether it was a good idea or not. And then you act on that. And sometimes you just stay the course because you say, I know this is right. We've just got to stay focused and prioritize, and it'll work. And then sometimes you say, you know, that just does not feel right. We got to change. Do it now.
Yeah. And it's probably difficult to say that sometimes when you've been the biggest proponent for that plan, or when there's a lot of financial resources tied to it, that, man, we're going to just have to flush all that money down the toilet and start over. But this is the right thing to do. And it's better to do it now than than later on when it's even more expensive, right?
Well, and that's probably a key point too that I think about as you're talking, is that the good leader also will always take the responsibility. Mm. He'll not blame somebody under him or around him or anything like that. He'll always take the responsibility and say, you know, I knew it was there. I didn't move fast enough, and we're going to have to regroup, or we're going to have to do something different, or I didn't have the right resources. But he'll never go out looking for someone in the organization to blame so that he can still look good. Mm. People pick up on that very quickly too.
Yeah.
It's all about the big guy at the top. You know, he's only worried about himself and not the people or the company at all.
Yeah. And it goes back to, you know, the relationships you've built and the rapport that you've already established will then diminish.
Yeah. Take the heat.
Yeah.
You know, you're in the best position to take it anyway and protect the people around you.
Yeah. That's great. This principle, as far as continue to learn, what experience in your life comes to mind when you think of that you've always tried to continue to learn?
Well, one of the things that I see now as I look back over my life is that you went to school, you went to college, you start to realize now that 50% of what they taught you at college wasn't true. and it wasn't that they, you know, were trying to deceive you. It's just that the world moves on and more discoveries take place and better principles are uncovered, et cetera. You find that you have to continue to learn. One of the things I saw just yesterday was talking about the fact that the illiterate of our time going forward is not the people who can't read or write. It's the people who can't learn and unlearn and then be retrained to learn something new again. Mm-hmm. That's the world we live in. And so you have to be prepared to continually pay attention. What I did 40 years ago in the insurance industry, I mean, I didn't even have computers really to work with, or laptops, the kinds of things, or my gosh, a cell phone that is an iPhone. I can remember thinking that was just a phone. Well, it's not. It's a computer that's bigger than what I used to have 20, 30 years ago, would have taken up two floors of a major business
yeah.
building.
Yeah.
So learning is a continual process. And I think especially when you put the eternal consequences to it, we realize if we're supposed to become who Heavenly Father has asked us to become, like Him, then we have to continue to learn. When I was at Ricks College, I can remember going into this old professor who taught chemistry, and I was afraid of chemistry. And I went in to check out of his class. I'd taken his first test, got an A on the test, but it just scared me. I thought, I don't like chemistry. And he said, young man, you're going to check out of this class, but I'm telling you, someday you're going to have to learn chemistry. And that has haunted me all my life because I knew he was right. How can I do all these other things that Heavenly Father might want me to do if I don't understand chemistry?
Yeah.
At some point, I'm going to learn chemistry. And so life is, there is so much to learn. If there's one thing I've learned as I'm at the end of my career, with my business career, is how much I don't know. It continues to change. The basic principles, yes, they're there. But the world is so full of so much to learn. I love to go to meetings. I love to watch programs because I always learn something every day. Once you got your degree, that just said, you know how to learn things. But now, are you paying attention to the world around you? Are you continuing to take classes? Do you go to seminars? Do you go to activities where you're going to learn something? I'm always intrigued at people who go to certain conventions that come and then don't go to any of the meetings, but they want to go off and go golfing and stuff like that. And I don't want to miss any of the meetings because if I learn just one thing from every meeting, if I take it one thing, just one thing back and can implement it, I am eons ahead of my competition because they were out golfing and I just learned one thing that caught my attention that I could implement, which makes me and the organization I'm working with better. So education is a continual process, and I've come to realize that it's an eternal process. I think there's lots for us yet to learn.
Yeah. Yeah. There's an eternity to do that. So.
And the only limitation we have here is time.
Yeah.
But in eternity, that goes away.
Right. Yeah. That'll be helpful. Any specific, like you said, there's so much information out there and so much to learn. Sometimes myself, I get overwhelmed by it and think, I can't listen to, every last audiobook, read every last book that's out there. What's your regimen or approach to learning? And you go on to talk about having a balance in life where, when you go to a conference, you have that purpose, but you also right. need to golf sometimes in your life,
oh,
right?
Oh, sure. And the thing is in many of these activities and events, there's plenty of time to do that.
Yeah.
But I don't need to do it all 4 days that I'm gone. And they usually have different events that give you that social interaction and all those kinds of things. And so that's great. Take advantage for how the planner set it up. But I think also looking for other kinds of education. I got very involved with Covey and all of their programming and planning and how to prioritize your time and life. When you start looking for things, there's thousands of different things out there. And you'll find certain things that start to talk to you or that appeal to you. But I learned from Stephen Covey how to prioritize my time, how to prioritize my day, how to prioritize everything, whether it's my church assignment, et cetera, because that's the other thing. You've got to keep your life in balance of our family, our church, our careers are all really very important. But you can't over-accentuate any one. If I do nothing but spend time with my family and let my church calling go, then am I going to be in a position or worthy to take care of my family? If I don't take care of my assignments at work and I lose my job, is that going to help my family? I have to keep them all in balance because if I spend too much time at any one, if I'm a workaholic in my career and I never am home for my family and I'm not spending time in my church responsibilities and my relationship with Heavenly Father, I'm losing. And so I have to prioritize and I have to keep that in balance. But you want to make sure it is truly in balance. And so sometimes you have to take some quiet time and be alone and think about things. One of the advantages that I've had in the last 37 years is I've commuted from Orem to Salt Lake in my job. And I've done that for a lot of years, but it's been a blessing. I haven't looked at it as, well, gee, I have all this time on the road. There are times when it's a lot longer than I like, but but it gives me time to think about the day. What did I do today? And to prepare myself for what am I going to do when I walk through that front door as a father, as a husband? Am I going to come loaded with all the problems that I've had all day, or am I going to walk through that door with a smile on my face because I now know that I've got to give some priority time to my family? So how we balance our lives, I think, becomes very important. And you have to take the time to think about things and to think about your life. And what am I doing? Am I spending it all in one area and not a balance in all the others?
Yeah, I like that. Just the, you know, thinking about it, the transition times between home and work or work at home and processing. Okay, now that, how can I be present once I'm there? But that you can't just, you know, go from a ward council meeting to the next meeting to the next meeting without maybe taking even 30 seconds and saying, okay, you know, where am I at? Am I, and I love, you know, I've interviewed Greg McEwen as far as he asks this question of what matters most right now, you know, and really being intentional with those transitions from one task to the other.
Right? The hardest part is being honest with yourself.
Right.
Because you say, this might be an A priority and this might be a D priority.
Yeah.
But I really like that D. I like that. That's right. Really where I want to spend my time. Well, the reality is you'll find the time to get that in. But if I keep chipping away at that top priority every day, even if it's only 10 or 15 minutes, well, in the course of a week, I'm well down the path in accomplishing that particular objective. So being able to prioritize and keep it all in balance, I think, is probably the most honest PPI priesthood interview we have with ourselves.
Yeah, I like that.
Every day.
Yeah. And we get so caught up in our schedule of, you know, interviewing other people. But right. And I think Elder Ballard's mentioned some of this in a recent conference talk of really having an interview with yourself and saying, you know, where am I at? How am I doing? What needs to adjust? And without taking that time and being intentional about it, it's not just going to magically pop into your head and fix itself for you. So
right.
Love that. Well, Don, this has been fantastic. I don't know, is there any other thought or principle that we haven't hit?
You know, one thing that has been important to me is, and I would tell anybody who is trying to do what they're supposed to do and trying to become a good son or daughter of Heavenly Father, is don't ever be afraid to live by your values and your principles. Don't be afraid to make sure people know who you are. I learned this very early when I was in the military. My first assignment, I was with the 9th Infantry Division, and I was on the battalion commander's staff. And his first question was, Lieutenant Adams, are you willing to come to my officer's call, which they're drinking and all that kind of stuff? Because I put out always very quickly who I am and what I stand for. And I said, absolutely, I'll come to your officer's call. Just make sure you have plenty of orange juice. And he looked at me and he said, you're on. And I went. And I always went to his officer's call. And I'd get my orange juice and I'd socialize with the other officers and then I'd go home. Well, later on, he told me, he says, Adams, you were the best thing that ever happened to me, because he said, you've cut my alcohol bill down tremendously, because all of these other young officers thought they had to drink. And actually, they didn't want to drink either. But because you said, just make sure you have plenty of orange juice, half of my officers are drinking orange juice now and not all my liquor. And I thought, wow, it was great. So interesting. But I just turned it into a positive thing. And I was always known for that. And I had many, many rich missionary experiences in the military. And because I'd say, no, that's who I am. And, you know, even going through basic training, those kinds of things, a lot of interesting things where your values were put on to test. And I learned also, even after the military and in my career in the business, there's a lot of people that they have different values than you do. But a lot of people have the same values you do as well. And so I'm very quick when I'm in any setting to let people know who I am, that I have a large family and this is where my focus is. This is what I do. This is what I love. This is what I'm about. So that there's no question. In fact, I've been with some of my business associates who will go in for dinner and they'll tell people, listen, if you don't have Sprite or something like that, you go find it because this guy doesn't drink. And they wouldn't allow me to do it if I wanted to because of the way I set the stage with them and the relationship, again, that I had with them. They would go out of their way to protect me and keep others away from me that they knew didn't have my set of values. So if there's one thing I would tell everybody, don't be afraid of the values that we have and the beliefs that we have. You don't have to flaunt them arrogantly, but you can easily stand up for them. And if there's other people that don't like that, well, you probably aren't going to have a positive experience with them anyway. But don't ever be afraid to get up and walk away.
Love that. And what a lesson on leadership. You know, not that you were looking to, you weren't trying to increase in rank or anything. You were just standing for your values. And that is a great leadership experience, is when we have opportunity to stand for what we believe in. And that's leadership. You know, that's great. As I do on most interviews, I ask a final question of as you look back on both your professional and religious leadership experiences, being a leader, how has it made you a better follower or disciple of Jesus Christ?
I've always said everyone should be a bishop at least once or be in that kind of a leadership role because it gives you a different appreciation. And it forces in some cases, or at least enables you to come closer to the Savior. All of these experiences are meant to give us experience that helps us to turn to the Savior because we're all just trying to come home. We're all trying to get there. This isn't home. This is our temporary place. And I think if you come in with the right attitude, you work hard, and you do all these things that we've been talking about, even if you're not in that kind of a calling, leadership isn't just by position only. It's by how we act and how we perform any of our responsibilities. You can be a great leader and be in the nursery, and the kids may love you and they'll do anything for you because you were a great leader and you handled your calling appropriately. I think leadership is as much about following as it is trying to say I'm in charge of everything, because everything that we're doing is to truly follow the Savior. Anything else doesn't really matter. It's when you finally realize through all these experiences that all of this is about trying to develop the characteristics which will allow you to have the discipline and which will allow you to have the fortitude to keep trying when things are tough or you're discouraged, but to turn always to the Savior and to follow Him. And so it's always about following. And I think the great leaders know how to follow the Savior.
A big thank you to Don Adams. What a fantastic interview. I really enjoyed taking notes in his office and learning from him, from his vast leadership experience. I know the insurance world, especially those at Bear River Mutual, will miss him as he retires. And a big thanks to Nathan Mills for suggesting this interview. This is how we get the best interviews, people, is for you to email me and say, I've got just the guy or gal, emphasis on gal. We need to get more ladies in on the Leading LDS podcast and hear from their leadership experience in Primary Relief Society and various, youth leadership callings, whatever it is, they have a great perspective as well. So if you know somebody who I should reach out to and interview on the Leading LDS podcast, go to leadinglds.org/contact and send me a message. Let me know who it is and why I should interview them. And there's kind of, we do have to be a little more selective now. We get more and more requests, but hey, if they're a good one, I'd love to reach out to them and make sure we get them on the program. Hey, and don't forget the Teaching Saints Virtual Summit coming up early next year. Go over to leadinglds.org. Make sure you're on the newsletter so you don't miss out on any updates coming from that. As always, folks, be a leader and not a calling.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. When the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness. The loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.